The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our program for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return one last time to the January 2020 edition of Our State, Celebrating North Carolina. We read about four winter perfect weekends in various places and some other things, but we are going to get to the feature at the back of the magazine. They have been doing a series on the decades. We've done the 40s and the 50s, and it's time to cover the 60s. And so, in 2019, author Philip Gerard explored the people and events of the 1950s. As our series continues, we're drawing inspiration from the pages of a 1962 magazine, where the promise and prosperity of this state earned it the nickname Dixie Dynamo. This month, a preview of the decade that propelled North Carolinians toward new opportunities. 1960s, a new series, The Dynamic Decade, written by Philip Gerard. Momentum has been building, and by the early 1960s, the payoff is clear. Now in the national spotlight, North Carolina enters an era of action and activism. There are some articles here. Some photos, excuse me, before we get to the articles. The caption says, Bridge to the Future. The 1960s brought the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge, a brand new gateway to Wilmington, a professional basketball team, the Greensboro-based Carolina Cougars, and an exciting win for Junior Johnson, racing fans, what's his number? Number 27 at the 1960 Daytona 500. Here's a picture. The old Ford down there, number 26, being passed by number 27. I don't know my cars well enough to say what that was, but the other one's a Ford, I'm quite sure, especially since it says courtesy Ford in Charlotte, North Carolina, 360 horsepower on it. And 27 is passing. He has a mere 320 horsepower, but apparently a heavier foot on the metal. The story is a publicity agent's dream come true. 43 pages of admiring prose, lushly illustrated with full-color maps and photos, in one of the most popular periodicals in the country, National Geographic. It appears in February 1962 under the byline of Malcolm Ross, featuring images by B. Anthony Stewart, the magazine's chief photographer, North Carolina, Dixie Dynamo. Because we love to see the change of the seasons, Ross writes, my family and I 7 years ago began coming north from Florida each spring to a cabin in the Blue Ridge of North Carolina. He describes the topography of the 500-mile-long slice of America sweeping west from the long, lonely beaches of Hatteras ever upward to the mile-high crests of the Blue Ridge and the Great Smokies. Then he arrives at the thesis that will drive the next 42 pages. Most important is today's human geography, the people whose composite energies make this a forward-looking, eagerly progressive state. The story offers welcome national recognition for the efforts of so many who have been laboring since World War II to fulfill the state's promise in education, business, agriculture, transportation, tourism, science, conservation, quality of life, the arts, and civil rights. Dixie Dynamo sets the tone for the coming decade. The National Geographic story comes 2 years after the new decade blows in with a massive snowfall in the western counties, lasting from mid-February through the first weeks of March 1960. In some places, temperatures hover below freezing for the duration. As 55-mile-per-hour winds pile up drifts as high as 20 feet in Ashe County. But seasoned residents take the blizzard in stride. They weathered storms nearly as bad in 1917, 1936, and 1942. Now the North Carolina National Guard, the American Red Cross, the U.S. Army, and even the Boy Scouts pitch in to help those in snowbound areas. Helicopters deliver food, fuel, and hay for animals. Bulldozers and other snow-clearing machines arrive from the coast. Some view the concerted statewide relief effort as an overreaction, but it is characteristic of a citizenry and a government inclined to act, not just observe. Under a succession of activist Democratic governors, airborne veteran Terry Sanford, Daniel K. Dan Moore, and Robert W. Bob Scott, the state earns its dynamic moniker from its aggressive recruitment of new business for Research Triangle Park and other locales, continuing the Go Forward initiative of Governors W. Carr Scott and Luther Hodges. But the dynamism doesn't stop there. In education, sports, and civil rights, North Carolina is a state of creative ferment, struggling through a controversy and the pall of the Cold War to excel an opportunity. The North Carolina Arts Council is founded, led by Sam Reagan, a legendary journalist, editor, and renowned poet, with the goal of extending the reach of the arts into every corner of the state. And Doc Watson, a flat-picking guitar master from the Deep Gap, becomes a star in the folk music revival that's sweeping the country. As more and more people leave the farm for industrial work, it becomes clear that while they may not need a 4-year university degree, it takes more than a high school diploma to be competitive. A 1952 study authored by Dr. Alan S. Hurlburt for the State Board of Education recommends that the board establish community colleges, and in 1957 the legislature agrees to fund them. By 1961, 5 junior colleges specialize in arts and sciences, and 7 industrial education centers focus mainly on technical and vocational training. To coordinate the efforts of a growing number of both types of schools, the legislature in 1963 establishes the Department of Community Colleges. By decade's end, it oversees 54 institutions, serving nearly 60,000 students. New sports teams play for enthusiastic fans. In 1962, Kinston gets a minor league Pittsburgh Pirates affiliate, the Kinston Eagles. The state's first professional basketball team, the Carolina Cougars, adopt a regional approach to creating a fan base. While most Baines games are in Greensboro, they also play in Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Raleigh. Wake County Speedway, a clay oval day track, opens. NASCAR is coming into its own, with television coverage making it a national sport instead of just a southern one. At the Charlotte Fairgrounds Speedway, 22-year-old Richard Petty of Level Cross finishes first in the 100-mile NASCAR Grand National event. His first big win, worth a purse of $800. Junior Johnson, a veteran moonshiner of Thunder Road in Wilkes County, now driving a 59 Chevy Impala, outraces a 68-car field and wins the Daytona 500 in its purse of just under $20,000. Meanwhile, the large military presence in the state, while less robust than during the war years, confronts a new kind of war, an atomic standoff with the Soviet Union. And it's dangerous in new ways. On January 24, 1961, a Boeing B-52 Stratofortress headed to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base and carrying two Mark 39 thermonuclear bombs breaks up in midair and crashes, unleashing its nuclear warheads near Goldsboro. One deploys its parachute and is recovered undetonated. The other smashes a deep hole into the earth. The secondary core of the bomb is never recovered. Experts estimate that if it detonated, either bomb would have had a lethal blast radius of 8 miles and irradiated the eastern seaboard as far north as New York. Progress often requires a struggle and carries its own hazards. The civil rights movement gains momentum on February 1, 1960. Four black freshmen from Agricultural and Technical College of North Carolina conduct a courageous sit-in at the Greensboro-Woolworth lunch counter. They are joined by a few others, then dozens, and at last hundreds, and they win their right to be served equally with white diners. The sit-in movement spreads across the state and throughout the South. Slowly but surely, desegregation efforts gain traction in North Carolina. Nationally, the decade is beset by violence, notably the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in November 1963 and his brother Robert F. Kennedy in June 1968. And on April 4, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is gunned down on the balcony of a Memphis motel. In response, students at Duke University stage a demonstration that becomes the silent vigil, which eventually swells to 2,000 participants. All of this comes as the Ku Klux Klan is resurgent across the state, especially in the eastern counties, establishing more than 100 claverns by 1966. Many local leaders push back against the Klan, but it dies hard and never completely. In 1966, the federal government designates Cape Lookout National Seashore. The southernmost portion of the Outer Banks lighthouses, the Lookout Tower, got its distinctive black and white diamond pattern in 1873. 14 years after it replaced the original 1812 lighthouse. Preserving the site for posterity means preserving the legacy of the light keepers and life-saving crews who once labored there. In Wilmington, the obsolete double-leaf drawbridge crossing the Cape Fear River, dating from the late 1920s, is replaced by a new bridge that delivers motorists to the south end of 3rd Street, the main thoroughfare to downtown. The bridge is of a striking vertical lift design. To accommodate ships headed to docks in the north end of the city, the 408-foot long center span can be raised 135 feet, remaining level. After 2 years of construction, Cape Fear Memorial Bridge opens to traffic in 1969, providing a picturesque modern gateway to the city. From the high vantage point of the bridge, travelers get a view of the newest addition to the western shoreline, the majestic USS North Carolina, the famed showboat that served in every major campaign in the Pacific Theater during World War II, from Guadalcanal to Tokyo Bay. The battleship is 2 city blocks long and as tall as a 13-story building. Now it rests in a permanent berth at Eagles Island as a museum ship, a bridge between the hard-won struggles of the past and the hope of a more prosperous future. Coming next month, the blizzard of 1960 blankets western North Carolina. And you are listening to our state magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments on our program, please call the studios 919-832-5138. And now, family trees. As the landscape changes around it, a homestead oak holds the memory of those who lived beneath its boughs so many years ago, written by T. Edward Nickens. The trail isn't much of a trail, but rather a wavering line of disheveled leaves, turning by the feet of deer and raccoon. I follow along the bluff, away from the creek, eyes on the ground as the land flattens and the woods run out to either side. In the winter, leafless and spare, you can see a surprising distance through the hardwoods. Overhead, tree branches twist and lattice dendritic fingers that reach at sharp angles toward the sky. Well, most of them do. Where the deer trail branches and braids through the open woods, I see three oaks on a slight knoll like Golgotha's crosses. Their branches bolt from the main trunk nearly horizontally, extending like muscle-corded forearms of a Greek god for 30, 40, and 50 feet through the forest. That's the first clue. Hiking closer, I see that the branches start much lower than those of other trees. That's clue number two. And from a distance, before I'm close enough to arch my neck to peer high into the tops of their crowns, each tree seems nearly symmetrical. They aren't lopsided like trees on the edge of a field, the branches on one side stunted by the shade. There's no doubt now, these are homestead oaks. Even before I knew what they were and what they represented, homestead oaks struck a deep, familiar chord. I'm not even sure where I picked up the term. It refers to a certain sort of large, mature tree, often an oak, but not always, that once grew in the open sun of a farmhouse yard or a corner of a field, but has now been subsumed by forest, surrounded by younger trees that grow tall and spindly. Before I turn the page, there is a picture of a very majestic tree here. It says, where the strong grow great, at 96 feet tall and 247 inches around, this champion Darlington oak tree is one of the largest in the country. It towers over an open field in Edgecombe County, and they kindly put a young person at the base of it. I didn't notice this at first, but when I saw 247 inches around, I said, no way. And now I see this person who's maybe, I don't know, somewhere between 5 and 5.5 feet tall, with his or her arm up. It's all taken sort of in silhouette here, so I can't really see the person. And they have an arm up. And this is indeed a big tree. I think if this person lay down across the base of it, they would not quite reach the full width of the tree. But I'm not going to do the quick math of pi r squared or whatever it is, tell you the, well, that's the area, not 2 pi r, whatever it is. Anyway, to figure out if that's the right measurement here. But because it's a silhouette of the tree against a golden leading up to a blue sky, we see what looks like to me fall leaves getting ready to come down. You can't really tell. There's a little color in the picture, but it's all kind of dark here. But it's a beautiful picture of the tree spreading out against the sky. It's really nice on one side, and on the other side it's got some broken branches, and it's all out here by itself. In deep woods, oaks grow tall and columnar, the seedlings shooting for the sky, racing all the other trees and brush to grasp as much sunlight as possible. But in the open, in a field or meadow or farmyard, oaks are on the slow burn. They grow thick and squat with crowns that spread in a great 360-degree circle like giant green cumulus clouds. Trees like this could shade porches and hold tree swings aloft for generation after generation. They might have once given a passenger pigeon a place to roost, or a Native American a harvest of meal-producing acorns, or a field-plowing mule a break from the sun. But once the old farmstead was abandoned, fields didn't remain fields for long. An open field grows thick with asters and goldenrod, then cedars and pines, and later the oaks and hickories take root. In 20 years, it might be hard to walk through. In 100, you might be able to see through the winter bare forest to the next ridge. In such woods, the broad spreading forms of the ancient homestead oaks are silent testimony to the past lives of the land itself. As I near the trees, the picture of the past becomes even clearer. I see a tangle of rambler rose grown wild and spindly. Rambler rose was planted along old farm hedgerows and could grow thick enough to hem in a backyard milk cow. In a few weeks, I'd bet the warming rays of the early February sun will tease bunches of daffodils from the base of the oaks. Spot rambler rose and daffodils together with a homestead oak, and you can practically hear an old screen door slamming and long-gone porch boards squeaking underfoot. I walk concentric circles, each loop around the trio of trees a bit larger in circumference, searching for other clues to whoever once rested in the shade of these homestead oaks or toiled in the farmhouse yard below their boughs. Homestead oaks have pointed me to many fine discoveries. Old enamelware pots that are now coral tools on my workbench, old embossed wine bottles that I've repurposed to hold olive oil, shards of pottery and stacks of wormy barn wood. But today, here, I can't find a single artifact that suggests who might have lived here. Perhaps someone else recognized these old trees and beat me to a mothered load of rusted bedsprings and old chimney brick. Or perhaps my instincts were wrong about those roses and daffodils, and those old oaks marked a property line or a fence row. So I step back 20 feet from the trees, and I look up into their tall crowns, interlaced with the branches of younger interlopers. In this modern era, we've lost a kind of arboreal vision. We struggled to understand what a truly old tree can be. A middle-aged oak might be 150 years old, and trees of that vintage are no doubt impressive. But before saws and plows and grist mills, oak trees could live for 5 centuries. For years, the national champion Overcup oak soared more than 155 feet above the forest floor in Bertie County. That's as tall as a 15-story building. A tree like that looms like a god in the woods, and as I study their gnarly forms, the lower branches alone, the size of lesser oak, I understand why the Druids held such trees sacred. In North mythology, there appears a massive old tree known as Yggdrasil, 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 whose branches reached the heavens. But I don't think the old farmers who toiled under those trees, or rather these trees, were given to such flights of fancy. These old homestead oaks anchored their world. They marked the edge of the farm or the corner of a field. And when a homestead oak shaded a deep front porch, its autumn leaves piling up against the raised seams of an old metal roof, such an old tree would have been the first thing some farmer of yore would have seen as he made his way back home. I think of him climbing that low ridge just as I did, the green tops of these trees rising like a vernal sun on the horizon. These days you have to work a bit to actually see one of the trees for the rest of the forest, but once they stood alone and silhouetted against the sky, a first glimpse of home. And now, in the few minutes we have left, the kindest catch. True to their Beaufort heritage, a mother and daughter bring the bounty to the coast, or rather of the coast, to their Winston-Salem Fish Market and Restaurant, where seafood and friendship keeps spirits afloat. Written by Debbie Moose. Growing up by the sea, with its tides and moods, fishing nets full or empty, is good preparation for the ebb and flow of life. Virginia Oden Hardesty and her husband Charlie were born and raised on the coast in Beaufort, children of commercial fishermen. They grew up among boats, nets, and the joys and hardships of making a living on the water. And both left that life for college and landlocked jobs in the Winston-Salem area. Virginia earned a math degree from North Carolina A&T State University and an MBA from Wake Forest University, and took a job with AT&T, later called Lucent Technologies, where she stayed for 17 years. Charlie earned a degree in industrial engineering from Elizabeth City State College, or rather university, and set about building his career, too. They had each other, and they had success, but they also shared a secret ambition to own their own business someday. So around 1984, they began talking about what that dream might actually look like in reality. Virginia remembers the day they picked their passion. Charlie sat down and said, "We're going to decide tonight." The result of that heart-to-heart is Forsyth Seafood Market and Cafe in Winston-Salem, which celebrated its 35th anniversary last year. "We knew what good seafood was," Virginia says, "and Charlie had been selling shrimp from a truck that he drove up from the coast, so we decided on a fish market. And just like that, across all those years, the familiar tug of the sea pulled them right back into the family business." Forsyth Seafood quickly outgrew its original location on Liberty Street and moved to a larger spot on Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, where it remains today. Customers walk in the door and turn right to purchase the bright-eyed flounder and snapper that arrive from the coast. But the hungriest guests turn left to dine in the cafe, which serves classic fried fish, plus steamed and broiled offerings and seasonal dishes such as catfish stew and gumbo. Regulars know that they're welcome to pick a fish on the market side, too, for the chef to cook up right then and there. Another thing regulars know how to do is check the whiteboard near the entrance, which welcomes them with a daily Bible verse. Inspired by their faith, the Hardesties have always tried to help the community around the market, which has struggled with declining property values since the foreclosure crisis. Through their church, Goler Memorial AME Zion, Charlie and Virginia started a program to feed the homeless. They also offered their expertise and encouragement to people sharing their own business, or rather starting their own business. Then in 2013, Virginia and the couple's daughter, Ashley Hardesty Armstrong, encountered a hardship of their own, Charlie's death. The community around the market rallied around them and made sure that Charlie's legacy of kindness was not forgotten. 2 years after his death, the city renamed nearby street Hardesty Lane in Charlie's honor. But the real testament to Charlie's work walks through the door of the market every day, the customers. He was helping the little guy start a business, helping kids go to college. Grown-ups will come in and say, "He helped me get this or that scholarship," Virginia says. "He was a humble man, not much for talk, but the city appreciated what he did." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Certainly hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments, questions, call the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.